Cindy gonna start?
Blog Talk Radio.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this Constitution,
my fellow Americans,
the United States of America.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for
this nation. Under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
So sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
From the very heart of the Constitutional Republic of the United States of America, from the soul of the Bellwether State, Missouri Grassroots Radio is live.
We are live. It's Constitution 101 night. It's session four. It's session four of Constitution 101, and we're going to talk about the founding of the state of Rhode Island, the state whose motto is Live Free or Die. How appropriate, right after Patrick Henry's Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech at the intro. Lisa's here with us tonight. Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Good evening, Dave. I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm great. You have a good weekend?
Yes, I did. Very fast again. You know, the weekends are always fast. Trying
they
to get ready.
They do go. And last Tuesday night, you gave us the exciting news about your daughter being accepted into the university with an academic scholarship. And congratulations again to her and to her teacher, who is you. That's you.
Yeah, how about that? We like homeschooling, and we're very proud. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Okay, and before we get started on tonight's show, we have another exciting announcement. Tuesdays on Missouri Grassroots Radio are going to get hot after the first of the year. Absolutely something you don't want to miss. Tuesday nights on MGC Radio will start sometime after the first of the year with a 7 o'clock show by Cindy McGee. Cindy's been on Lisa's show several times. Now, Cindy was going to start maybe as early as next week, but there's been a family death, so our prayers are with Cindy, and we'll wait to hear from her. But soon after the first of the year, she will be coming along with a Tuesday night show at 7 o'clock, and then that will be immediately followed at 8 o'clock by a show called Homefront, and that's going to be hosted by Cynthia Davis, the First Lady of the Constitution, a recent candidate for Lieutenant Governor. And we're really excited about that, Teresa. What do you think?
I think that's very exciting. Cynthia Davis is always entertaining and always interesting. She's always got something great to say, so we're looking forward to that. And our prayers, again, are with Cindy McGee and her family for the tragedy and that they've experienced over the weekend. And we will be looking forward to her return after the first year as well.
And our prayers and thoughts also go out still yet, and for quite a while, to the families of the children and teachers slain at Sandy Hook Elementary. I have ceased from or resisted talking about this at all. Haven't blogged about it. Haven't talked about it on social networks. Have refused to get involved in any of the discussions that started about 15 minutes after the news broke from both the left and the right about gun control laws and how we need to stop the guns. We're going to talk about it a little bit tonight, though, Lisa, and we do send out all of our prayers and our thoughts to the folks at Sandy Hook in Newtown, Connecticut, for this tragedy. Just horrible, Lisa. Horrible, horrible.
I cannot even imagine. I mean, it's, yes, absolutely a horrible tragedy that took place over the weekend.
And like I say, within about 15 minutes of the news getting out, you had the righties saying, well, you know, if we had more guns, this wouldn't happen. You had the lefties saying, well, if we didn't have any guns at all, this wouldn't have happened. And the fact of the matter is that there is some room in the middle for all of that discussion. But what is sad to me, Lisa, about the whole idea of this fight now that started, and we'll go on and get vocal and vindictive from both sides, is that one more time we will totally forget about the culture of violence in America. And when I say culture of violence, I'm not talking about guns, brothers and sisters. I'm talking about a culture of lack of individual responsibility, a culture of apathy, a culture of incivility that leads to these things. I mean, America has always had guns. In the wild, wild west, everybody had a gun. The founders from colonial days to through the 40s and the 50s, everybody had guns. And nowhere in my upbringing, I'm sure yours too, Lisa, did this ever happen. I mean, it just never happened. There wasn't mass shootings in the wild, wild west. But here it is now, every 6 months to a year, we get another episode of this, and all the fights go on about guns and more guns and less guns, and who should have guns and who shouldn't have guns, and we never, ever, ever get serious. I mean, there's some discussion here about this guy's mom and what she could have done and this guy and what medications he was taking, but we'll not get serious about that. I mean, those will be come-and-go conversations. The battle over the guns will go on, and we will never get serious about what the hell is really causing this kind of... I don't know the answer, and I don't think anyone knows the answer, but until we get serious about studying and putting our finger on what is the answer to why kids walk into schools and shoot people. I mean, it's not about guns, you know, because we've always had guns. Until we get to those answers, it's not going to matter how few or how many guns we have, Lisa.
You know what? This whole situation is just ridiculous. You know, the man was obviously mentally ill. And, you know, occasionally in society, you know, and throughout time, people have been mentally ill. And occasionally one goes rogue and does some horrible, unspeakable thing. And that has been, you've had that since the beginning of time. And every time something like this happens, we have to do one of a couple of things. We either have to take away all the people's guns, because that's the only way to handle it, is, you know, if he wouldn't have had access to the guns, this never would have happened. Although, you know, we don't ever stop and think back, you know, Lizzie Borden killed people with axes. You know, she was mentally ill, and, you know, they had mentally ill people back in that time, too. And if somebody snaps and they want to kill somebody, they're going to find a way to kill somebody. Or two, we have to find a way to battle mental illness. Well, you know, mental illness happens. There's nothing that you can do to stop it. You know, I think in the culture as it's structured today has probably got the most proactive philosophies and programs to battle mental illness. Mental illness happens. You are never going to eradicate it on a full-blown scale. It's tragic. You know, you don't want to encourage it by any means. But the fact that when something like this happens, there has to be a knee-jerk reaction, that there has to be a solution to stop it, either way, is absolutely ridiculous. You know, and to look at the larger culture to fix the problem of the entire situation is ridiculous as well. You know, what you need to do is just be proactive in your family and in your community, and if you see something out of the ordinary, you know, you need to take care of it there. The fact that the government or the larger community has to have a one-size-fits-all solution to this problem is nuts, and these, you know, and we continue to have these conversations. To me, the whole thing is ridiculous.
Yeah, Lisa, I agree with everything you've said, but still, I want to see us do something to get to the answers of why. Yes, mental illness is an issue. Yes, it's not an issue we're going to fix, but what is occurring in the culture today that causes more cases of this mental illness than we've ever seen before in the past?
Why do you say that there? I mean, how many people? I'm not seeing that we've got weekly cases where people are going into schools shooting things up.
We're getting two or three times a year cases.
No, not two or three times a year, I don't think. You know, we've had, what, three in the last maybe 10 years?
Excuse me? But and I'm not talking about the schools. I'm talking about the theater.
Yeah, that's true. We did have a theater issue this year. Forgot about that.
Virginia Tech.
But, you know, the reality is, you know.
The mall? In the last month, we've had the three. We've had the theater, the mall, and now this one.
Not in a month.
Well, in the last quarter, at least. I can't remember when the theater was, but yeah.
Maybe it's a tightening and restricting of people's freedom. You know, or maybe it's the fact that, you know, we as a culture, for the last several generations, have been raised without consequence.
Well, there you go. You know, and that might be an answer. I was thinking of that just today. When I was a kid, and that's a long time ago, Lisa, a long time longer ago than when you were a kid. But I'm sure when you were a kid, there was some of this left, if not totally. But, you know, a parent had an incentive to ingrain a sense of right and wrong on their child. Because when I was a kid, my mom and dad were civilly and criminally responsible for whatever I did. I mean, if I went out and broke the neighbor's windows out with a rock at 10 years old, my parents were responsible for that, civilly and criminally.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure that they're not anymore, but I think what the difference is that you're civilly and criminally responsible, but you have no authority anymore to keep your children from doing whatever they're doing. Our parenting rights have been taken away to such a degree that you know, our authority has been lessened over our children.
Well, there you go. Okay, so then what you have is a whole generation or two of people who grew up with all this freedom but no individual responsibility that should go hand in hand with freedom.
But even then, Dave, you know, out of the population, okay, if we've had maybe four shootings in the last quarter, and how many billion people live in the United States, you know, even that in the population is a very small, small number of people.
I'm not saying it's a big number. I'm saying that in frequency or even in occurrence, I mean, when I was a kid, this did not happen. Didn't happen, period. I'm not going to say it only happened once every 20 years. It didn't happen. Now, something has changed, and it isn't guns.
Or the media. Or we didn't have the media coverage.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I mean, you know, and all I'm saying is these are the kind of talks that we need to be having, not more or less guns, you know, not more or less knives, not more or less. Now, I saw a note today, you know, that detailed how many people Timothy McVeigh killed, but you could still buy fertilizer and rent Hertz trucks. You know, those kind of things aren't the kind of talks we need to be having, but the shame of it is that when all that vile and vindictiveness from both sides is over and done with, nobody will still be talking about this thing we're talking about. What? I don't know what, but something has changed inside the human psyche of the American individual. That is bad parenting, or it's lack of being able to parent, or it's no responsibility, or it's a lax civil justice system, or it's too many drugs in our kids, or it's undiagnosed mental illness, or it's overdiagnosed mental illness, or who the hell knows? I don't. But it's damn near time we started talking about those things, because you can take away all the guns in the world, and until we fix whatever that problem is that's causing this to occur, we're going to have mass knifings in the next, you know, at the next Batman opening.
Well, you know, I don't know that I would go that far, but I would definitely agree there are issues within the culture that absolutely need to be rolled back.
Right. So that's my take on it, and I'm going to stay out of the gunfight. You know, you guys can go visit my blog if you want to see where I am on the gun thing. I'm not anti-gun by any means, so don't call and say, why are you anti-gun? I do think that in a country that has the kinds of social and cultural problems we have, that we're too free about giving guns to too many people. There's not enough, you know, I mean, for Christ's sake, every American has a right to drive a car, you know, but we test your skill before we give you a driver's license. And if you're infirmed and you can't see or in some way are epileptic, we don't give you a driver's license. So there's nothing wrong with having a,
We do that with guns. I went through a class and had my skill tested to be able to get a permit to carry a gun. Yeah. And I went through a background check to buy my guns.
Okay.
To check for mental illness. We do all that with guns.
How did you go through a background check to check for mental illness? I want to know. Did they ask you who your psychiatrist was?
They do a complete background check to see if you have any prior history of mental illness or any convictions of crimes or any diagnoses. They do all of that.
Are you suggesting that if I go see a psychiatrist next week, that record is available to anyone who goes looking for it?
Yeah, I'm suggesting that.
No, it's not. Okay. You know, you can't do a background check for mental illness. I mean, you can do a background check for whether someone was hospitalized for it. You can't even do that. You can do a background check on whether someone has been
they do check for mental illness on their background checks. If you have a prior history of mental illness and you've had a diagnosis and it's come up in a record somewhere, they can find it on your background check and they will not issue you a gun.
If it's come up in a public record somewhere. Okay, you're right. But 99% of diagnosed mental illness isn't in a public record somewhere.
You know, they've started diagnosing post-traumatic stress disorder mm-hmm. in our vets.
Right.
So that's on their permanent record to keep them from having guns. That's an issue. I'm telling you, you need to look that one up. That is an issue. Well, they are putting that into the record. Mental illness is an issue in whether or not people are issued guns.
What if I go to my private doctor and get diagnosed with it instead of a VA hospital or rely on the government to help me with it?
You know, that's interesting because I do remember going to a new doctor recently and filling out the form, you know, that you fill out when you go to a new doctor.
Yep, a form,
and
yeah.
The survey at the form, I mean, they wanted to know if I owned a gun.
Really? Wow.
Yes, they're keeping records and they're keeping data. I mean, we've talked about it before on my show. They're keeping data on all kinds of things. We've talked about the census surveys, the long form, the Obama forms, and the surveys that they do in schools, the data that they keep on kids in schools that have absolutely nothing to do with whether or not you can add 2 + 2. And I'm telling you, they're keeping data on you, and it shows up.
Well, I'm telling you, when I get the long form, census form in the mail, I put my name and my age on it, and I send it back with everything else blank. And when my doctor's office asks me if I own a gun, I just say no, or I leave it blank.
Right. But ask.
Okay. So I'll look that up, and we may do a whole show on that. That's scary. Well, you've already done whole shows on it, haven't you? So there we go. That's about all we're going to get to on that tonight. And meanwhile, Boehner and Obama have another talk this afternoon on Boehner selling out the conservatives and the fiscal cliff issue. And Obama is going to end up having his way with that, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was never any incentive for him to negotiate. He's in charge. Why would they negotiate that one away? They're going to give him everything he wants.
That's right. So here we go. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to jump right into what we're here for tonight, and that is Constitution 101, the birth of religious liberty, the birth and death of religious liberty in the United States of America. We're going to talk about how that was dealt with in early America, long before anybody ever dreamed of a constitution, and what the philosophy was that led to the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America. We'll be back with that.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
For peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
We are back. That's my favorite all-time early American quote, the one by Patrick Henry. And we're going to deal probably one of these weeks upcoming, specifically for the entire time, with Patrick Henry. We're going to spend some time here in Constitution 101 dealing with individuals who had an impact. Not necessarily, I mean, we will get to the ones who actually put a pen to paper and wrote the document. But what we're trying to do here with Constitution 101 is this. We tend to talk about the Constitution and the intent and things like that, looking back through the prism of history. And what happens is we get a really distorted picture when we look back like that, because we're looking through 2.5 centuries of distortion. We're looking through 2.5 centuries of supposed quote unquote scholars. And chief justices of the Supreme Court who cared nothing about the original intent and what liberty was, but used the word a lot. We get a very distorted picture by looking at the directions that our culture and our history have taken us. We get some very distorted pictures by looking at people like Abraham Lincoln and even Thomas Jefferson, as though they were something larger than life, as something more than what they are, which is human beings who make errors sometimes. Everything that all of these people did was not 100% in the course of what's best for liberty and for what they said they stood for. And so what we get is a very distorted picture of what America is as it was supposed to be. What America was built on can only be discerned through a very hazy glass when we look back through history. What we've done instead is we've gone to the other side of the Constitution. I was talking with a friend today about this very topic, and from the other side of the Constitution, if we talk about the people and what impacted their lives and what they were doing and how they interacted and what battles they were fighting and what their philosophies were and where they got those philosophies and who they studied, how they talked to one another in conversation, in correspondence, then we can discern what these people wanted to get out of this thing, what these people were trying to do, were trying to build, right from where they lived, right from who they were. You can pick up Moby Dick, and you can You can read it, and you can take a whole college semester of ferreting out the symbolism and ferreting out what the novel means and ferreting out what Melville was trying to say. But what you're getting when you do that is a very foggy picture of what some professor says white whales mean and what some professor says one-legged sailors mean in the overall scope of a story. If you really want to know what Moby Dick means the way Melville wrote it, you would have to spend an entire college semester studying Melville, going back to where Melville was born and how he was raised and what he believed and what he thought and how he felt about things and what kind of demons he was fighting. And all of these things to know what he was building when he built this story. And that's why we're doing this. I was in a heated discussion just this week with someone over a totally different issue. And she said something snippy to me like, "You think you're a constitutional scholar?" And I said, No, I am anything but a constitutional scholar. I mean, I took the classes in school that satisfied my curiosity. I took some Constitution classes just because I love to learn things. But the Constitution isn't what I studied. Here is the thing, though, folks. Constitutional scholars are our problem today. I'm not your problem. Constitutional scholars are your problem. The Constitution of the United States of America is a short document, and what it says is sixth grade civics. It's that simple. You know, when the Constitution says the government shall do this and the government shan't do this, that's what it means. There isn't any symbolism in the Constitution. There isn't any literary guise in the Constitution. It just is what it is. It's written down on a piece of paper in black and white, and there it is. You don't need to be a PhD in Constitution USA to read the damn document and say, this is what it says. You know, it says the government can't do anything. The federal government can't do anything to take away your right to have a gun. It really is that simple. You know, we can spend 2.5 centuries of Supreme Court justices arguing back and forth about whether that's what it says, but by God, right there it is on a piece of paper. That's what it says. So what we need to do is we need to go back and cut through all this centuries and centuries of minuscule little discussions about whether or not you have a right to privacy and whether or not it is in fact an illegal detainment for a police officer to stop you on your way to work just to see if you've been drinking in a long line of people just to see if they've been drinking and whether or not that's constitutional. What a ridiculous argument to have out of the Supreme Court, and what ridiculous results those arguments get. I mean, it's insane that seven of the supposedly most learned legal minds in the United States of America can discuss whether policemen can stop my ass in a long line of people while I'm already almost 5 minutes late for work just to check and see if I've been drinking and say that that's all right after they sit around and talked about it for 3 months. It's insane. And so those are the prisms of distortion that we have to look at when we look backwards to the Constitution. And they don't do us any service. So what we did was we took the first week and we talked about the political philosophies that went into the formation of America up to this point. Now we're really branching off nowadays. We're far from liberal, conservative, and libertarian now. We've gone way far right and way far left of any logical definitions of liberal and conservative to where we've actually but what we did when we did all that was we defined who these people were that left Europe to come to America, and they were by every definition libertarian. They wanted to be governed as little as possible to keep them from killing one another. That is what they wanted. And then we talked about their actual journey. They're getting on the Mayflower. They're getting their group together. They're getting the money up to do this. The tribulations that they were going through in Britain, and in a later week in other places they came from, like Holland, the Netherlands, some from Spain even. And what they were going through there and why they felt they needed to get rid of there. And we put a group of these people on a boat and we brought them over here. And we compacted the first agreed government by and of the people. A government totally devoid of any kind of hierarchy or inheritance or royalty, a government where the people decided who the leader was going to be and whose leadership, and that leader's leadership was available for removal and replacement at any time by the people. And then we took those same people and we spread them out for various reasons, to a point where they were then 13 colonies. We're going to back up a little bit, and we're going, and in a way now, we're going to start really defining the very earliest precepts of the mindset that was colonial America. And remember now, these people landed at Plymouth Rock in 1620. The Declaration of Independence was in 1776. So there is a century and a half, a full century and a half between the time people landed at Plymouth and the time that we broke from England. And then we have a whole war, and we have all kinds of other things before we even get to the Constitution. So there's a lot of history even that goes into the life and the culture and the philosophy that led these people up to the Constitution of the United States. There's a lot of experience in there that you need to know about. There's a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of infighting. There's a lot of vanity and jealousies. There's a lot of things that went into these people that found their way into the Constitution. And until you know these things, you can't possibly imagine for 1 minute that you know what the Constitution is about. We're going to talk today about a fellow named Roger Williams. And Roger Williams was probably the American father of freedom of conscience. Roger Williams, and here's the prelude to Roger Williams's biography. Pilgrims and Puritans came to America seeking religious liberty for themselves. Roger Williams arrived in America seeking liberty of conscience for all. Protestant, Catholic, Jew, Muslim, unbeliever, and pagan. That basically, I think, wraps up Roger Williams in a nutshell. Roger Williams was trained, brought up in England, in the Church of England. He was raised and educated at Cambridge in the ways of the Church of England. He became a theologian within the Church of England. And while schooling, while doing further schooling at Cambridge, he decided that the Church of England, which was a Protestant offshoot from the Reformation, from the Roman Catholic Church, had kept on too many of the trappings of Catholicism, and wasn't really even a Protestant church. Now, let's talk about Protestantism in Europe for just 2 seconds here. Every church, until the foundation of the United States of America, every nation had a national church. That's where you get words like Russian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox and Church of England. And every one of these, it's interesting, if you could just spend the rest of your life studying these things, and I haven't, but I've read about them. It is interesting to note that the basic theology or the mores of a church, let's just take the Church of England, changed every time the rulership changed. So the Church of England tended to take on a doctrine that aligned itself with the personal doctrine of its ruler. Very convenient for the ruler, not so convenient for the people. And in every country, to one degree or another, you were required to be a member of this church. In some countries, you were required to actually attend the church, England for one. Great Britain in as a whole, not just England. And in some countries, Great Britain for one, you were required by the government at the point of a gun, to tithe money to the church. In other words, your tithe to the church was really nothing more than another tax. It was collected by the church, but that collection was enforced by the government. And that harkened back, that kind of thing harkened back, as far as Roger Williams was concerned, to too much tie with the old Roman Catholic Church that Protestantism had theoretically severed itself from. I know, don't call me and say, but Catholics aren't like that. No, they're not, but they were. And if you're a Catholic and you're into your own history, you know they were. So he broke then with the Church of England. And became a Puritan while he was schooling at Cambridge. And then he went on to evolve a little bit more as he studied more. He became privy to the plans of the Puritans who wanted to migrate to the New World, and he actually helped them do that. Now, the Puritans were a kind of a odd sort themselves. There were two branches of Puritans. There were the Puritans who Williams was currently associating himself with, the Mayflower Puritans, who felt that the Church of England had it right, but they just were a little bit still too quote-unquote Catholic. They didn't like the trappings of the Catholic Church. They didn't think that priests should wear headgear that exalted them to almost a godly status. They didn't think that a parishioner should bow before a human to take the sacraments. Little things like that they thought kept the priesthood at a high enough layer above the mere mortal that it was almost Catholic, Roman Catholic in nature. And then there was another group of Puritans who thought that the Church of England was just way too corrupt to ever be saved, and these were separatist Puritans. They thought they had a corner on morality, and as does every religion. So if you're a Puritan, don't call me up and say I'm trashing you. I know you're not a Puritan. I don't think there's any Puritans left, Lisa.
Did they die out?
Well, I just don't think anybody calls themselves. I don't see anybody in those big Puritan hats walking around town, do you?
No.
So I guess I don't see any scarlet S's or any I don't see anybody burning at the stake when I go downtown either. So no. I think the Puritans probably are gone. But anyway, go ahead.
Unless they're Tea Party members.
Well, yeah, that's true. So anyway, there was this group of Puritans who thought that they should separate completely. And the more and more Roger Williams got into this Church of England Puritanism, the salvation of the Church of England, they really believed in the Church of England. They really wanted to try to save the Church of England, and they thought it could be saved, somewhat like Republicans today that you hear saying, we're going to save the Republican Party. These people really, really honestly wanted to save the Church of England. But the more he got into this, the more he realized that he was more of the philosophy, or becoming more of the philosophy, that the Church of England just was too embracive of its own power, that the leaders of the Church were just too proud of themselves to ever let the Church of England become a church in the body of Christ, as he would have called it. That it was too worldly corrupted, and he became a separatist Puritan. About the time that he made that conversion, he made a 1632 trip. He did not come with the Pilgrims in 1630, but he did make a trip in 1632. About the same time, he became a separatist and joined the first group of Pilgrims in Plymouth Colony. He was welcomed at Plymouth Colony and actually given a mentorship in the Church of Salem. But he immediately began preaching this new separatist philosophy that he had, talking about how the Church of England was unsalvageable, and how people needed to kind of start being their own conscience and quit relying on the priesthood to direct their lives. And that didn't go over too well, as you can imagine, with the people in Salem, who had already, in the year that they had come to Massachusetts, they'd been there, remember, a winter and a summer now before Williams gets there. He arrived on the HMS Freedom in midsummer 1632. So in just less than 100 years, the Plymouth Colony had become a place that you wouldn't recognize from the folks that landed there. They were literally stoning and pressing and waterboarding people who spoke badly of their church, who were not exactly cooperative with the new Puritan church, with the Church of Massachusetts. And Williams spent very little time in getting on the wrong side of that crowd with his talk of how corrupt the Church of England was. By 1635, he had been twice summoned before the court for heresy and for speaking ill of the church, and each time they had come to some agreement that he would cease doing so, and they let him go, and he'd gone right back before long to preaching what he thought to be the gospel that they didn't particularly think to be the gospel. And finally, in 1635, he was summoned to court to answer a serious charge that he had been preaching, quote, erroneous and dangerous preaching. The court then, now this is how mixed up the government of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, of the Plymouth Colony, and the church had become, about how entangled it had become. The court, the civil court, removed Williams from his position in the church. Now, can you imagine that? He was called into a civil court to answer charges of heresy, and the civil court removed him from his position in the church as a punishment. That was enough for him, and he left the Puritan movement completely and became a Baptist. Now, I don't want to get into the different theologies here, because there are certainly all kinds of legitimate theologies. But if you're a Baptist today, you may or may not understand what you are, because it is not true of the Baptist today, as a general rule, that the fundamental precept of the Baptist Church is an impenetrable wall of separation between church and state. I mean, you never know that by the way the Baptists are going after the old vouchers and the way the Baptists are going after the old faith-based initiatives for welfare, and by the way the Baptists are going after prayer in the government schools. But the fact of the matter is that Baptists are not Protestants. They were not part of the Reformation. They preceded the Reformation by a little more than a century, or they were around preaching and being persecuted a lot over this basic doctrine that there had to be a wall of separation between church and state. And in fact, while we give Thomas Jefferson a lot of the credit for the quote-unquote wall of separation between church and state, he did borrow that term from Roger Williams, who wrote this in 1644. "First, the faithful labors of many witnesses of Jesus Christ extant to the world, abundantly proving that the Church of the Jews under the Old Testament and the Church of the Christians under the New Testament were both separate from the world, and that when they have opened a gap in the wall of separation between the garden of the church and the wilderness of the world, God broke down the wall itself, removed his candlestick, and made his own garden a wilderness, as it is to this day. And that if he will ever please to restore his garden and paradise again, it must of necessity be walled and peculiarly unto himself from the world, and that all that shall be saved out of the world would be transplanted out of the wilderness of the world and added to the garden of the church." Now, what he's saying here is that God intends this wall of separation between what is holy and what is unholy. He intends this impenetrable wall between himself and a worldly government. And that as soon as the government of the world makes a break in that wall, his garden, his world, God's world, is contaminated. And God removes himself from that and lets the whole thing run together. Because he insists that anything that is holy and righteous be separated from anything that is worldly. And Williams contended that the Christian lives that life, lives a life with one foot in the world and one foot in the garden and a big wall right between his legs, and that those two must never be mingled, or they mingle at the contamination of both. So Williams believes strongly in this Baptist precept that there was a wall of separation between the church and the state, and that never, ever, ever should the government of man tread on the liberty of conscience. And this is something that Williams was adamant about. There is no religious liberty. There is only liberty of conscience. For religious liberty is nothing more than tolerance. That is, we will tolerate your faith, or we will tolerate your lack of faith, or we will tolerate your hedonism or your atheism or your paganism. We will tolerate those things. Now, when you tolerate something, you are already, just by the very fact of tolerating it, setting yourself above it. In other words, I'll put up with these pesky little pains in my back to get through this softball game. I'll tolerate that. I will tolerate these whiny kids because I love them so much. I will tolerate this ugly next door neighbor's yard because I want to get along. But when you tolerate something, you are already putting it in a category where it is something soiled or wrong or a nuisance or something that is below you, but you are willing to allow to occur. So religious liberty is not something to be striven for. It is not something for which you should aspire, religious liberty, because religious liberty in and of itself simply means that you have placed your religion as better than everyone else's. What you should strive for in human government, according to Roger Williams, is a liberty of conscience. That is, what I believe about God is a truth to me, but it is between myself and God alone, and it has nothing to do with you. What I do for right and wrong is between God and I alone. Now, you can live with that if you believe in liberty of conscience, and you're not tolerating the atheist, because even though he does not believe in God, or denies that any God exists, in your world, that is between him and God alone. And it makes him no more or less than you, because he answers to God for that. Give me half a second. We're going to take a break here. I've got to look something up because I've forgotten. I mean, the name of the guy who I wanted to go to next, who gathered a lot from Roger Williams between the time of Williams and the writing of the Constitution escapes me. And so I want to get there next. We're going to take a quick break since I'm running out of air anyway, and I'll come right back.
This is the Grassroots Minute. Everyone knows that the city of Detroit faces a major financial crisis, but one member of the city council thinks President Barack Obama should step in and help. Nearly 75% of Wayne County voters pulled the lever for Obama in November, and according to Detroit Councilwoman Joanne Watson, President Obama owes the city a government bailout for supporting him in the 2012 election. In a recent council meeting, Watson said,
"After the election of Jimmy Carter, the Honorable Coleman Alexander Young, he went to Washington, D.C. He came back home with some bacon.
Right.
That's what you do. That's what you do. This is our people in an overwhelming way supported the re-election of this president, and there ought to be a quid pro quo, and you ought to exercise leadership on that. Of course, not just that, but why not?
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth."
We're back, Missouri Grassroots Radio. We're waiting for Dave to come back on the line. He was busy looking up some information that he wanted to get right on his religious freedom subject. Dave, are you there?
Thanks, Lisa. I appreciate that. I had to actually step out for a minute and take care of business, but now I'm back, and I did find it. John Leland was a clergyman born in Massachusetts and a student of Roger Williams, and what I want to use him for right now is to reinforce what I've been saying about Williams. And I want you, if you're at all interested in this, go study Roger Williams and verify for yourself that everything I'm telling you is right. Don't ever come to this show and take anything that I say as gospel truth. I'm going to tell you it is. You know, that I spent two whole days on this show right here, getting my timing, getting my Williams down. But don't ever come to this show or Lisa's show or Sean Hannity's show or Glenn Beck's show or any other show and walk away believing that you have been imparted some truth until you go and all any of us should ever hope to do is give you the push in the right direction. So what I'd like you to be able to do is leave this show tonight so that you could use Google and about 20 minutes of your time and verify that everything that I've said in 2 hours is true. And then you can walk away knowing that this is so. So anyway, there's this student who was a young man when he was studying, when he was a student of Roger Williams. And he migrated to the Congregational Church from the Church of England about the same time that Roger Williams migrated to the Baptists. And here's what Leland said after having been influenced for an entire career by Roger Williams. Every man must give an account of himself to God. And therefore, every man ought to be at liberty to serve God in that way that he can best reconcile to his own conscience alone. If government can answer for any individual at the day of judgment, let men be controlled by it in religious matters. Otherwise, let men be free. So what he's saying here is, until the state can answer for me to God, then the state has nothing to say about the way I behave within my own consciousness. Now, we're not just talking about whether I'm a Baptist or a Methodist or a Catholic or a Church of Englander or an atheist or an agnostic or a Muslim or a Jew or a pagan. We're not talking about just that. We're not talking just here when we say liberty of conscience about the way I view God. We're talking about a liberty of conscience. We're talking about everything that we try to reserve as a moral, quote-unquote, government today. We're talking about gays. We're talking about abortions. We're talking about everything that does not, well, in fact, at this point, we're talking about everything. We are talking literally about everything. Now, we're going to reach a point when we get down to what do we govern, to what we have to take, which of these rights we have to deprive you of in order for us to live together without bloodshed in the streets of St. Louis, Missouri every day. And there are some things that government must do. But at this point, we have reached a point where everything that you do, say, think, read, eat, drink, teach your children is solely between you and God. It is more than a religious liberty. It is a liberty of conscience, and it is important to get this right, because this guy, Roger Williams, we will find out, was such an influence on Jefferson and Madison that this intent that we're talking about flows all the way through to the Bill of Rights. Now, that was our little sidelight into what Williams believed that led him away from the separatists even and to become a Baptist. I took that sidelight to what is a Baptist, because it is ultimately important for you to understand where this man who had such a tremendous influence, that he separated all the way from Massachusetts and began a new state whose motto is live free or die, and then went on in his writings and his speaking to have an influence three generations later on men like Jefferson and Hamilton and Madison. And you have to know what this means when I say he was a Baptist, because if you're a Baptist today or if you're not a Baptist today, you really haven't got a clue what it means to say that he was a Baptist, because it's a whole different bucket of worms today. So he left Massachusetts after being banished. In 1635, he was banished from Massachusetts, and he began the Community of Providence, which later became the state of Rhode Island. Once Providence and the several surrounding communities were united under one quote-unquote state government. The government of Rhode Island and everything from where I say quotes is actually in quotes from the Charter of the Government of Rhode Island. The government of Rhode Island declared itself a, quote, government of civil law only and a government of total freedom of conscience. So what we had here was a government that dictated that it was simply going to maintain a civil society and leave all matters of conscience to the individual. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, we do get to a point then where the government has got to sit down and say, okay, what do we regulate? Well, we have to regulate because we believe in individual freedom. In freedom of conscience, that Dave can't kill Lisa because Lisa has the exact same freedom as Dave. Lisa has the exact same liberty. She was born of the exact same creator. She has everything in the world coming to her that Dave has coming to him in terms of freedom and liberty. So Dave can't kill Lisa because to do so would be to steal that liberty. We have to say that Dave can't steal Lisa's car because that's Lisa's personal property, and as such, it is part of her liberty. She's earned that by investing part of her life in something that earned her enough money to buy this car. It is exclusively her car, so we have to say that Dave can't steal Lisa's car. Now, do we have to say that Dave can't have sex with Lisa's dog? Well, no, we don't. Because, well, I guess if Lisa doesn't give him permission to, since that's her property. But come on now, how about his own dog? Can Dave chop down his own tree? Can he paint his roof green? Can he, you know, name it. Just go on and on and on and on and run down the things that your city says you can't do. And all of these became specific questions of this government that believed in liberty of conscience, and everything that they did as part of the civil law went back to this liberty of conscience. And so So it mattered not what God thought of any particular action in their eyes or in anyone's eyes. It mattered not what they thought of any particular matter. It only mattered that civilly, the right that I was expressing in any action did not interfere with a right that you were expressing or entitled to. And that in a nutshell was the first foundation, that Rhode Island government was the first foundation of a civil government that recognized the wall of separation between church and state. Now, in 1664, Roger Williams went on and left the Baptist Church behind over the doctrine of closed communion, and that is you can only take communion if you're a member of the church. This wasn't a church-state issue. It was simply a theological difference between himself and the Baptist Church. But it is important to know this because for the rest of his life, that is between 1664 and 1683, Roger Williams, the American father of the separation between church and state, the American father of liberty of conscience, never again associated with an organized religion. He believed from that point forward that organized religion did nothing but contaminate the liberty of conscience. And while he remained spiritually active, while he continued to preach at any church he was in for the rest of his life, while he continued to write heavy-duty theological works, he refused to associate with any organized religion for the rest of his life. Now, what I want to do next, and that's Roger Williams. We're going to leave Roger behind with the wall of separation between the garden of God and the wilderness of the world. But we are going to march down the timeline a little bit because it's important to know. Now, as we move from Williams's death in 1683 towards 1776. I want to review what things were going on at the same time as those things we were talking about tonight, in specifically Williams and Rhode Island, and how these things all worked together to create a framework of personal philosophy for the people who a century later would sit down to write a constitution to govern this country for, they hoped, eternity. In 1634, about the same time that Roger Williams was becoming a separatist, the Commonwealth of Maryland was formed. It was formed when Lord Baltimore came over from England to escape the Church of England. He was a devout Roman Catholic, and he came over to escape the Church of England, its anti-Catholic Protestantism. He settled on the Maryland, what is now the Maryland coast, and there was a long and painful history for Maryland. There was a coup d'etat where Maryland went from Catholic to Protestant. And then there was another coup d'etat 5 years later where the Commonwealth went back from Protestant to being a Catholic Commonwealth. And neither of these coups was bloodless. So in Maryland, there is a serious battle going on. And again, on religious grounds, by people who came here seeking what? Right, religious liberty. And this is about the same time, remember, that Williams is becoming less of a Puritan and more of a separatist, and forming his first true, deeply held philosophies of this liberty of conscience, and the idea that to strive for religious liberty is nothing more than a human frailty, because religious liberty is only about, ever, about your religious belief. Religious liberty is only ever about seizing the power for your God. You may be to some degree more or less tolerant of the other people's gods, but religious liberty is never anything more than your right to suggest, without anyone else telling you otherwise, that your God is right and everyone else's is wrong. And right about the time that this Maryland battle was going on between all of these religious liberty freaks wanting their religion to be the predominant religion and everyone else's religious liberty to be subservient to some degree or another to their religious liberty, is about the time that Williams is beginning to preach liberty of conscience rather than religious liberty. In 1635, Williams moved by force from Massachusetts to Rhode Island. In 1643, about the time that Williams was becoming a Baptist, the New England Confederation, a defense pact, was formed between the several states. Interestingly, at this point in time, Williams is being asked by the people of Massachusetts who banished him to please join with them in defending against some of the native tribes that were really, really causing serious bloodshed in the New England community. 1649, the Maryland Toleration Act was signed. Now, this is a funny act, and this is, again, about the time that Williams is talking about the wall of separation between the garden of God and the wilderness of the world. The Maryland Toleration Act suggested that no law could be made that would allow for the persecution of Trinitarians. So you were free, you were totally free to be in any church and follow any religion that you chose, as long as that religion believed in the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. You could not deny the Godhood of Jesus and the presence of the Holy Spirit and be covered by religious liberty. You were persecutable if you did not believe in the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost Trinity. This was envisioned at the time by the folks in Maryland, who, by the way, had come over here, remember, from England to escape religious persecution and to enjoy religious freedom. This was hailed by the people of Maryland as a brand new, wide open, beautiful religious freedom thing. If you are anybody who believes in the Trinity, you are totally free of any persecution by the government. So we're going to be tolerant of Methodists, of Pentecostals, of Episcopalians, of Church of England. We're going to be tolerant of Catholics, of Protestants, of Baptists. We're going to be tolerant of anybody. All you got to do is believe in the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, and you're welcome here. About the same time that Roger Williams was deciding that all of the churches were corrupted by the world, the first blue laws were written in Connecticut. And these blue laws had to do with what you could and couldn't do on a Sunday. There was some upheaval when these laws were first written by the Jewish people who celebrated their Sabbath on Saturday and counted Sunday then as their first work day of the week. But that didn't much matter to the people of Connecticut because they weren't Jewish. At least the ones in the state house weren't. So in 1682, the same year that Roger Williams became sick and shortly before he died in early 1683, Pennsylvania became a province, and quite nicely and civilly recognized that they were going to allow religious tolerance for any and all Methodists. On the backdrop of all of this, on the backdrop of all this religious freedom and the schisms, Carolina becomes a colony. The colony of Carolina, and within a decade had split into North and South Carolina, and once again, along the lines of religion. So while all this is going on, between 1631 and 1683, the lifetime of Roger Williams in the New World, Roger Williams, who later would have as students Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Alexander Hamilton, was preaching that religious liberty is not something to be aspired for, and that what needs to be aspired for is the liberty of conscience. Did this have an impact on the philosophy of the people who came along after? You know, we're really wasting our time here tonight unless it did. I mean, because we are talking about Constitution 101. Thomas Jefferson says this: "On the face of my tombstone, I want not a word more than this: here is buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence and of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, father of the University of Virginia. Now go read the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, and you will see, Google that, Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, it's what it's called, and you will see quickly that the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom is right out of the mind of Roger Williams. Thomas Paine: all national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. James Madison, the religion then of every man must be left to the conviction and conscience of every man. And it is the right of every man to exercise it as he may dictate. Thomas Paine, mingling religion with politics may be disavowed and reprobated by every inhabitant of America. Andrew Jackson, while I concur with the Synod in the efficacy of prayer and in the hope that our country may be preserved from the attacks of pestilence, and that the judgments now abroad in the earth may be sanctified to the nations, I am constrained to decline the designation of any period or mode as proper for the public manifestation of a reliance on God. I could not do otherwise without transcending the limits prescribed by the Constitution, and without feeling that I might in some degree disturb the security which religion nowadays enjoys in this country in its complete separation from the political concerns of the general government. So what a church in New York, on an outbreak of cholera or plague, had asked the president to proclaim a national day of fasting and prayer. We have a national day of prayer now, don't we? Here's what he said. I am constrained to decline the designation of any period or mode as proper for the public manifestation of this reliance. I could not do otherwise without transcending the limits prescribed by the Constitution, and without feeling that I might in some degree disturb the security which religion nowadays enjoys in this country in its complete separation from the political concerns of the general government. Ulysses S. Grant, leave the matter of religion to the family altar, the church, and the private school. Supported entirely by private contributions, keep the church and the state forever separate. Rutherford B. Hayes, we all agree that neither the government nor political parties ought to interfere with religious sects. It is equally true that religious sects ought not to interfere with the government or with political parties. We believe that the cause of good government and the cause of religion both suffer by such an interference. Marion, Ohio, 1875. So, somewhere between 1875, when the intent of the founders was still quite obvious to American public officials, and now that intent has been lost, and we cannot find it again by looking backward through the dark and gloomy prisms that have become the scholarly divisions of what the Constitution is and was. We can only find that by going back to the people who fought the battles that made it what it was, who lived the life, who melded the philosophies, who went through the pains, who shed the blood that became the Constitution. Only by knowing them and by understanding what they believed and why they believed it in the backdrop of the time that they lived, can we ever get to what this kind of liberty meant to those people. And only by knowing what this kind of liberty meant to those people can we ever, ever imagine what they intended when they wrote the Constitution of the United States of America. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with a recap for the night, and then we're going to say so long.
You better watch out. You better not cry. You better better not pout. I'm telling you why.
Here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, it's Christmas in July and August and September. Last year on Christmas Eve, MGC paid off the department store layaway accounts of two Missouri families who were not able to provide Christmas for their children. This year, we would like to at least double that number, and in an attempt to do that by the holiday season, we're asking you to consider donating a few dollars toward that effort. We know the holiday season is the most difficult time of year to ask for donations, so we're planning ahead and asking you to give whatever you can so that a few Missouri families will be able to celebrate at Christmas. Go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and look for the Secret Santa page. All the details are there for you to donate by PayPal, check, or money order. Conservatives have proven to be the most generous and most benevolent people in the United States. Please help us with this very small charitable project.
His life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
So we are. We're back. We've wrapped up the night. We've talked all night long about religious liberty versus the liberty of conscience, and how the paramount philosophy of the founders was more in tune with a liberty of conscience than with religious liberty. We'll come back next week, and I intend to talk more about. I really kind of wanted to start with this one because it's ever present in today, but I actually rearranged a little bit because of the events of this week. But next week we're going to talk about why guns were so important to the founders, and we'll talk about why they were important to the founders and why the philosophy of freedom to bear arms made it to the Constitution of the United States, and what the backdrop was for that. And from there, we will once again overthrow two centuries of Supreme Court precedent by discerning through sixth grade civics again what was the intent of the founders when they wrote this. It really is easy, isn't it? It really is easy. When you go back and when you look at the lives that these people led, when you look at the reasons that they did the things that they did, which are very discernible from what they wrote, from what they said, from what was going on in the world around them, then intent becomes crystal clear, doesn't it? Wednesday nights, Lisa comes along with the Culture Vigilante. Don't miss that. She's had to go. So I'm not sure who she'll have this week, but it'll be fun and it'll be exciting. Thursday night, Kevin comes along with his Hillbilly Logic Hour. Always great. Man, Kevin can pull down some star power in his guests. I never miss Kevin's show. Sometimes I don't catch it live, but I always catch it by going to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.com and clicking on the archive and catching his latest show. Tuesday nights, beginning after the first of the year, are going to be dynamite. We'll start at 7 o'clock on Tuesday nights with Cindy McGee, and then we'll follow her immediately at 8 o'clock with Homefront, hosted by Cynthia Davis. An hour each from two powerful, powerful voices for liberty in the state of Missouri. Secret Santa. Look, we're getting close, man. Christmas is right around the corner now. It's, 8 days. 8 days till Christmas Eve. So we need those dollars, folks. We need them, need them, need them. Go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. Click on the Secret Santa button. Use the PayPal there to send us $2 or $5. We want to give some Christmas presents to kids who would have no Christmas presents this year without your help. We want these kids to have some Christmas. And look, the state won't do it, will they? They're too busy. Fixing the fisheries in Alaska with their Hurricane Sandy fallout money. So no time in Washington D.C. for those kids right around the block from you who won't have anything for Christmas. go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, click on that Secret Santa button, and send us $2 or $5 or $10 or whatever you can afford, please. No overhead, no salaries, no expenses, no advertising. Every penny you send buys some kid who would have nothing for Christmas a present. I'm Dave. You can contact me at David Court, DavidCort. That's my name. David Court at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. You can click on MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org anytime you want and click on the blogs button and you can read the stuff I write. You can tune in here every Monday and hear the stuff I say. You can call any Monday at 347-677-1835 and disagree if you want. I can take it. Can you? For Missouri Grassroots Coalition, this is Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Dave. It's the end of our Monday night. We love you all, and we'll catch you Wednesday. Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.